But if it's true that the physical grows out of the mental, essentially, then I don't see why an individual consciousness would be dependent on a physical brain, because in fact, the physical world is growing out of consciousness.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Jim Tucker on the show. Dr. Jim Tucker is a child psychiatrist and the Bonner Lowry Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. He is director of the UVA Division of Perceptual Studies, where he is continuing the work of Dr. Ian Stevenson on reincarnation. He's been invited to speak about his research on Good Morning America, Larry King Live, and CBS Sunday Morning. And he recently published the book called Before, Children's Memories of Previous Lives, a 2-in-1 edition of his previous books. This is a really fascinating episode, folks. In this episode, I talked to Dr. Jim Tucker about the science of reincarnation. Yes, there is a science behind this. We delve into his research findings and methodology on children who claim to remember their prior lives. Dr. Tucker notes that these children don't just recall biological details of their past, but they also retain feelings and emotions. His findings have important implications for how we understand consciousness. We also touch on the topics of morality, trauma, quantum physics, and panpsychism. The implications of this really run deep, and while there's still a lot of questions that remain, I had a lot of fun chatting with Dr. Tucker about what's possible. I hope you enjoy this episode just as much as I do. So now I bring you Dr. Jim Tucker.
Really nice to meet you.
Yeah,
nice to meet you too. I'm utterly fascinated with your work and don't know why it's not more mainstream, quite frankly. There's so many implications of it for so many areas of cognitive science that I study. And it runs deep to consciousness, issues of consciousness, issues of even free will, you know? So there's so much to discuss.
Well, that's right. But yeah, it's not more mainstream because it challenges a lot of the sort of mainstream assumptions. Mm. So it's easy for people to ignore it.
Yeah. So, well, before we jump into the deep end, I wanted to get a sense of some of your biggest influences. I do get the sense that Dr. Ian Stevenson played a huge role in your work, and even to the extent that you're kind of carrying the baton, like I like to think I'm carrying the baton from Abraham Maslow, you're carrying the baton from Dr. Ian Stevenson. So can you talk a little about his work and the work he initiated in like 1958, I believe?
Right. So, yeah, he came to UVA in the late 50s to be chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and had never done any. He had an interest in parapsychology, but he had never done any. And he was still in his late 30s when he came here to be chair. I mean, he's having quite a successful mainstream career, mostly or much of it looking at psychosomatic kinds of things. But then he got intrigued by this phenomenon of young children in different parts of the world who said that they had memories of a past life. And he started trying to investigate those cases and find out exactly what the child said and whether they in fact matched a life from the past. His work, Ian once said on the obsessive compulsive scale, 1 to 10, he was an 11, and he liked to get all the details right. So he was very methodical in studying these cases. And eventually stepped down as chairman of the department to focus full time on them and then spent the bulk of the next few decades studying these cases. And we've continued to do that.
So Dr. Ian Stevenson, yeah. So that's interesting. I didn't know that he would score high in OCD. So he was really, do you get the sense from reading his writings that he really wasn't biased to a certain conclusion, that he really wanted to amass as much evidence as possible to before he made up his mind? You know, I don't even know if he ever made up his mind completely. But yeah, do you get that sense that he really wanted to get as much data as possible?
Yeah, he was basically trying to determine for himself. So, yeah, as we all are, I mean, we're research questions are ones that we're questioning. In his case, he had become persuaded that the strongest cases that reincarnation was the best explanation for them, but not the only. So he certainly left that door open that he could be wrong about it, but he was persuaded that, you know, there was people no longer had to accept reincarnation on faith. They could accept it on evidence if they chose to.
Well, he coined the term psychophore, right?
Yeah.
P-S-Y-C-H-O-P-H-O-R-E, soul bearing. What was his thought about that? Why did he find the need to coin such a term?
Well, right. So he was, his idea was that if he had these memories and emotions and behavioral characteristics in a life, that if they continued on into another life, as these cases appear to suggest, then there would have to be some sort of vehicle to carry them. So rather than use a term like soul or spirit, you know, some sort of religious term, he felt that he should coin a new term that didn't have connotations that were not necessarily consistent with the work, or certainly not consistent with the attempt to look at this in sort of a serious, objective way as opposed to a religious way.
Yeah, because even just people listening to this conversation, even they're like, oh, they're talking about reincarnation. Reincarnation, it might be hard for people to even have a model in their head that one can discuss this in a scientific way. So we're going to, let's change some people's minds here today in the sense that we can show them that we can have this discussion in a way that is evidence-based. And so, Doc, what I find interesting is Dr. Stevens, he has this quote, reincarnation is the best, even though not the only explanation for the stronger cases we have investigated. That was the quote that got to the closest when I wanted to know what his conclusion was. And you're not Ian Stevens, you're your own human. So as a jumping point from that, I want to, you know, continue the rest of this conversation today on what you've discovered and what you've concluded, maybe have similarly and differently from Dr. Ian Stevenson, even though he was a huge mentor of yours. So you kind of popped on the scene in 1996, on the reincarnation scene. You reincarnated in 1996. You left your private practice in psychiatry to go all in on this. So this was a motivation. Like, there was a moment, like Howard Gardner calls it a crystallizing experience, right? Where you're like, this is it. This is what I want to do with my life moving forward. So how did that happen?
Yeah, it was a real fork in the road, for sure. And I think, to back up for a step, it basically, the big fork in the road, when my wife and I got together, it opened me up to, to be frank, to experiencing life in sort of a different way, a more fuller way, or a fuller way. And she was open to these kinds of things in a way that I had not been. So that got me intrigued. So I was reading about different things, and I was actually reading one of Ian Stevenson's books, when I learned that his research division here at University of Virginia had gotten a grant to do a new study on near-death experiences, not reincarnation, but near-death experiences. So I just called them up to see if they needed help with that study, and sort of one thing led to another. But when I left my private practice to come on here, I have continued to be a child psychiatrist. So about half of my time roughly is spent doing clinical work, patient care work, helping to train the residents and the fellows. So it's not like I left it all behind, but I did decide that I was going to do the work that I wanted to do. And, you know, if it didn't work out, I could always go back into private practice. But in the meantime, I was going to explore this area. Again, the question of life after death is something that, you know, interests all of us, at least to some extent. But what really appealed to me was the serious-minded sort of scientific approach, evidence-based approach that was going on at UVA and that I wanted to be a part of.
Yeah. It must have also felt a little bit like a rebel, right? Like there must be some bone in your body that, like, you know, maybe like just a personality trait you maybe have had your whole life where you're like, you know, like I'm going to, you know, take on the establishment a little bit.
Yeah, actually, I'm quite the opposite. I've always
Fascinating.
Pretty much a straight arrow, rule follower kind of person. So, yeah, it was a step out of my comfort zone. But again, the approach is mainstream. It's looking at a topic that people don't usually apply these methods to, but it's the same end goal of seeing what we can discover.
Yeah, I bet you see all sorts of explanations for things that make you roll your eyes, you know, like that are just so outside of the evidence base. And you're like, well, you know, I don't think the evidence suggests that's true at all. But here's a fact, a fascinating fact. Some young children say they have been here before. Okay, that's the fact. Now, what derives from that? Well, lots of things can be investigated to try to understand that. And you probably always get asked, what's the mechanism? Right? And there's all sorts of explanations. I would like to go through in a systematic way and discuss, first of all, the main characteristics that you see. And we'll go through it. I have the list. And then I also want to discuss some of the potential explanations for it. And then I want to end with your thoughts on what's going on based on the totality of the evidence. So one thing you often see are just the most simplest, most conceptually associated with this idea, which are past life statements, right? So these kids, usually between the ages of 2 and 5, talk about someone else's whole life, right? And they seem to have memories of it, right? So can you elucidate a little bit what exactly the nature of that looks like?
Yeah, it's very much memory in the sense that it's from one person's point of view. They're not just spouting facts, but more of what to them feel like memories, and often focused on the end of the life. So 3/4 of the kids talk about how they died in the past life. They remember the death. And most of those are some sort of violent death or unnatural death anyway, murder, suicide, accident, combat, that sort of thing. And with those sort of traumatic memories can come other memories too about family. They may express a lot of emotional attachment toward previous parents. They may tell their parents, you're not really my parents, but my parents live in such and such place. And they, at times, will give enough specific details, which pretty much have to include names of places or names of people, but give enough where people then verify that their apparent memories do in fact match a life from the past. A lot of them will also show a lot of emotions. I mentioned that the attachment to the previous family, many of them will show phobias toward the mode of death the previous person had, that the kids may act out various aspects of the past life in their play. So, again, it's not just information that they seem to be connecting to or that seems to have carried on, but the whole, that feelings and emotions have carried on as well, it seems. These kids do this spontaneously. It doesn't involve hypnotic regression or anything like that. And they come from all over the world. That we've studied over 2,500 cases. And while they're easiest to find in cultures with a general belief in reincarnation, they happen everywhere. So it's with the American cases, most of the parents did not believe in past lives before their kids started talking about one. So it's not like anyone created this for or led them to believe these things. It's just something that arises from them, that they have these emotional memories that they describe.
Great. And few of them are famous people. It's not like they're really prominent cases. Would you say that the 100% of these cases can't be explained away by somehow the kid finding a news article, you know, somewhere, or watching something on television about a really violent death of someone? Can you say that you have investigated that systematically and 100% of the cases can't be explained away by that?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say 100% for anything, but in the strongest cases, for instance, some of the kids will talk about either a deceased family member or a deceased person from the same town or village. So those, you always wondered, did they learn about the previous person by natural means? But with the stranger cases, I mean, there where they remember being a stranger, there are plenty of those where it's essentially inconceivable that they learned about this stuff through normal means. Now, there may be other explanations for the cases, but not that they somehow read a news article about this person who lived 50 years before and that, died in without anyone knowing about them. I mean, that's just not a reasonable explanation for most of them.
Fascinating. And, children have wild imaginations, right? And you have enough people on Earth, I could imagine something right now, and then statistically it probably would match up to some, I could make up something right now, be like, I'm Johnny who died of a bullet to the head in the war. I bet there is someone named Johnny who died with a bullet head of the war. So just statistically. Now, do you think that can fully explain it as a rich imagination that just happens to match a prior life?
Well, it depends on the statement. So, yeah, like you said, or if someone says, I was Bob and I was killed in a car accident in California. All right, well, they're going to be a lot. So you have to look at how the specificity of the statements. So there are a lot of them where it can only fit one person.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a well-known American case of a kid who talked about being a World War II pilot who was shot in the Pacific and gave the name of the aircraft carrier, first and last name of a friend of his, described where he died, described how he died. And there was only one person in history whose life matched those details. So, you know, you could say it's a coincidence, but that I don't think is plausible. I mean, that would be one heck of a coincidence.
One heck of a coincidence. And you tend to find that these individuals come from not necessarily the person's bloodline, but a certain vicinity to where they live, right? You don't tend to have prior lives of someone on the other end of the world.
That's true, although we do occasionally get those reports. And yeah, you know, if an American child says my last life was in Africa, well, I mean, there's no way to verify that without a whole lot more details. But with the ones that do have verifiable details, even the ones who describe a past life as a member of another country, there was often a geographical connection. So, for instance, Burmese children who said they were Japanese soldiers killed in Burma during World War II. Most of them are not related. They're not describing the life of an ancestor. So there's not a genetic connection, but there is, it is, for intact memories to come through, typically the past life was one that was reasonably close by, usually in the same country.
And then you also tend to see some past life behaviors, like unusual play among these children. Can you kind of elaborate what you see there?
Yeah. The most common is actually acting out the previous occupation. I mean, not just playing war like all kids do, but specific things like a kid who played repeatedly for hours on end at being a biscuit and soda shopkeeper, which the previous person had done. Some of them will kind of reenact the death scene over and over. That's not as common as the occupation, but we do have some of those cases. But sometimes the occupation ones are quite precise as well. So there's this kid who remembered being a nightclub owner and would even put out seats for his two wives. And it turned out that the previous person was somebody who fit that kind of description. So just taken on its own, the play may not necessarily be that impressive, but when you put it in with the whole picture, then it looks like it is connected to the memories the child has.
That's a great point. And I should have stepped back and asked about your methodology, because it is true that when you collect these reports, you tend to further investigate ones that show two out of a list of behaviors that there are multiple of these things. When I was reading into your methodology, is that correct?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There are a number of features that we look for. The most obvious is claiming to remember a past life. But then, yeah, there are behaviors that are appear associated with the memories. These are not common, but there are cases where the previous person made a prediction about where they would be born the next time around. There are also what we call announcing dreams, where usually the mom, when she's pregnant, will have a dream about a previous person saying, I'm coming to be born to you. And it seems like there are one or two other features that make the list for you. We have to have at least two of those to register it in our cases. Oh, birthmarks and birth defects that match.
I was going
to
bring that up.
Yeah, on the previous person. So the most common are the statements and the behaviors, but we get the others as well.
I thought it was interesting that, like, in India, where reincarnation is an idea that's in the consciousness there of the culture, a third of your cases from India include birthmarks or birth defects that are thought to correspond to wounds on the previous personalities, with 18% of those including medical records that confirm the match. My gosh, what do you think's going on with the birthmarks?
Yeah, well, I will say,
not like the child intentionally branded themselves, right?
I think we've ruled that out. But I will say the percentage is a little bit misleading in the sense that Ian Stevenson was really fascinated by those cases. So those that would affect which ones he would fully investigate. But yes, there are plenty of those cases out there. And yeah, it's ones where the child is born with a birthmark or full birth defects that match wounds, usually the fatal wounds on the body of the previous person. And they include like 18 cases where they have both entrance and exit wounds of somebody who was a gunshot victim. Deformities, like there was a case of a little boy who, the previous boy, lost the fingers of his right hand in a fodder chopping machine. And then the second boy is then born with missing the fingers on his right hand. And there are lots of those cases out there. We get some American ones like that as well, that they're not as common here. But we've certainly had ones, including one with heart defect, others with birthmarks. So yeah, it seems that if we accept the cases, if there is this sort of carryover of mind or consciousness, that sometimes traumatic either memories or even traumatic wounds can affect the developing fetus in the way that they show up in the baby.
Yeah, you talk about that in one of your books about the fascinating nature of how our mind can affect our bodies, you know, and how these things are intertwined, and maybe the consciousness creates the birthmarks. But it makes one question, where do birthmarks come from in any of us? Like, I have birthmarks, right? Like, why do I have birthmarks? What's the developmental explanation for that? Would a biologist be able to explain that to me concretely?
Well, I think most of them, the cause is unknown. Not that I'm an expert on birthmarks, but there are some birth defects in particular where there's a syndrome that's been identified, but for most of them, it's unknown. And, it's not necessarily a ton of research on birthmarks because they're usually benign. And Ian never claimed that all birthmarks were related to past lives, but just that in some of these,
but it makes me wonder.
Yeah.
Dr. Tucker, I have a confession. When I was 3 years old or so, we were in Disneyland, and I still remember this vividly. I remember this vividly. We're in Disneyland, and we were at the hotel afterwards, and I went into the bathroom, and I remember I was standing in front of the toilet, and suddenly I was like an old man in my head, and I saw my whole life flash before my eyes. Like, I saw like suddenly, like, I wasn't 3 year old Scott. I was literally like a mature old man with like, and all the things that come along with that. Like, I had lots of mature thoughts like that a 3 year old, wouldn't tend to have. And it freaked me out. And so much so that I remember this moment even today. It just disappeared. It just disappeared when I like walked back into the room. It was just this moment, where I literally felt like I was this old man now.
And of course, did it feel like you were old man Scott, couldn't you tell?
Hard to tell, but I still remember it vividly. Like, I remember that memory vividly. I mean, that's crazy. Like, I was 3 or 4, but it felt like. Like, I was, they're both were in me at the same time. I was the old Scott, knowing everything like that an old man knows, and being like, oh gosh, but I have this 3 year old body that has to like live it through. Like, I have to like go through the motions of living a life, but I see it at the end of the life. I see the whole life lived. It was the weirdest thing.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that, these experiences do happen to people. With our cases, we do have some where the child will talk with great emotion about a past life just one time. And then the parents will ask them about it a week later, they don't even remember it. But then there are others, where people will have sort of transcendental experiences, which, as a 3 year old, sort of being able to, or seemingly, stepping back from your day-to-day experience and seeing the big picture is something that happens to people. And, what do we make of that? It sounds like you sort of stepped out of time for an instant.
Yeah. 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 Just had a very mature way of, I wasn't a 3 year old at that moment, Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. So these are some explanations to consider, and I wanted to go through this. There are normal explanations, and then, of course, there are paranormal explanations. Let's start with the normal ones. You say, quote, "We approach the cases with an attitude of scientific curiosity. We are open to all possibilities." I mean, gosh, what a great scientific approach. I wish all scientists had that approach, quite frankly. I can't say all do. So normal explanations include things like, well, maybe these kids have fraud. Maybe it's fraud. What would fraud it's not like the kids are creating the fraud, but they're fraud conditions that make it look like those kids are saying those things, right? Is that one of that potential explanations?
Yeah, actually, Ian Simpson published a case published a paper on, I think it was 7 cases of either deception or self-deception. Sometimes, very rarely, where the child's family may be trying to get, say, money out of a wealthy family and say that their child was the previously family member. What's more common, I think, is self-deception, where the families may make sort of too much of the child's statements and then kind of build this story that the child was either a deceased family member in a past life or occasionally a famous person. I mean, I've gotten ones for famous people like Babe Ruth and people like that, which I mean, I'm not saying
skeptical.
The child wasn't Babe Ruth, I'm pretty skeptical.
Well, what do you do? What if you get 5 kids and they all say that they were Babe Ruth? Do you got to, like, they got to fight that out amongst themselves, like, you know, which is the real one?
Yeah, well, right. So, I mean, that almost never happens with kids, but we do get some reports from adults who feel like they were someone famous in the past. Often not because they have specific memories, but because of other aspects or coincidence or similarities. So, yeah, we've had a number of Thomas Jeffersons. I think that's the leading one, the University of Virginia. And, I mean, the adult cases we tend to look at with a fairly skeptical eye anyway, because if you don't have specific memories, I think it's very hard to even speculate about who you were in a past life. But again, I mean, that's a tiny minority of these cases. For the most part, there's no reason to think that the parents or the child, that they're committing deception. And typically, there's not even any grounds to think they would be committing self-deception.
You actually just made me think of a question, though. Have you ever had 2 children claim to have memories of the same person, not famous, you know? Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah, there are cases. One of our colleagues, Antonio Mills, up in northern British Columbia, studied cases of with the tribal peoples up there. And there are some communities where they will recognize a child as being a past life person on very limited grounds. I mean, they say a dream and they may decide, okay, this child was that person. And it's usually like a village elder or somebody that was well respected in the community. So not a famous person, but somebody that people looked up to. So there may be 3 or 4 kids who are all identified as being that person in the past life. But again, that's a real exception to
real rare, real rare. Yeah. Another potential explanation is, well, we already discussed this one, which is fantasy.
Yeah.
But I think we already discussed, and
I mean, I will say, if none of these memories could be verified, then I would have a great belief in the likelihood that this could be fantasy. I mean, kids certainly are capable of fantasy and say all kinds of things. Again, we don't take that at face value. It's whether we can determine that these statements actually matched a past life, but before we would think that it's more than just fantasy.
And then faulty memory by informants. How much could that explain the findings?
Right. So the idea is that the child makes some perhaps general statements about a past life, that the family finds someone whose life more or less matched those statements. And then after the families meet and exchange information, then the child gets credited with more information than they actually had. And there are certainly cases where that warrants serious consideration. But then there are all the cases where we've got written documentation of what the child said before anyone knew if there was a previous person. So we can be sure that there's not faulty memory in those because we've got written documentation.
And then this one is very interesting for a number of reasons. Genetic memory. This one kind of gets to the heart of a lot of things that I personally study. Our worlds are about to intersect in a second. You'll see why. But can you tell me a little bit about what that is? What is genetic memory?
Yeah, the thought is that the idea is that the memories would be transferred in the genes to the child. So it would not be some sort of paranormal kind of thing, but a physical transfer through the genes. But that does not explain... could not explain most of our cases, partly because most of the time the child is not talking about a direct ancestor, which they would have to be for the genes to come through. And also, most of the children have memories of how they died, which, of course, people die after they've already passed on their genetic material. There are a lot of very interesting facets to what can be transferred in genes, or at least epigenetically, but what kinds of memories perhaps can be transferred, but it doesn't seem to be a factor in these cases.
Well, hold up. Hold up. My own area of research, this is where our worlds intersect, and I've long been thinking about this. I've studied prodigies, and I've studied savants, and I'm very dear friends with a man named Daryl Treffert, who passed away pretty recently, and he was the scientific advisor to the movie Rain Man, but he was also the most knowledgeable, well-known scientist studying savants. And he had this idea of genetic memory. He thought that was the only explanation. He thought that was the best explanation for how a lot of these individuals with very low IQs even could sit down and paint something photorealistic, or sit down at the piano and play something amazing. And even in the prodigies realm, there's a lot of trying to understand how children under the age of 10 can just have a fully formed talent. It takes a little bit of practice, but it doesn't take that much input for them to learn. Yeah. It's not like the parents are pushing these kids. It's the kids are pushing the parents. And then I've studied at great length the idea of gifted children and the idea of prodigies. And my friend David Henry Feldman wrote a book about prodigies. And specifically in there, he noted that there seemed to be a higher than greater chance of these kids somewhere in their ancestry, there was someone who had a talent that resembled it. And he didn't rule out the possibility that there was some sort of genetic memory. Mm-hmm. So genetic memory has been brought into the discussion of these other domains like prodigies and savants. I don't know if you're familiar with any of these two individuals that I've mentioned or their work or writings about this, but I'd love to bring all these worlds together because I think there's something really, really, there's something going on. Yeah. There's something going on.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't doubt that at all. And it may be, it's conceivable that there's a genetic disposition to recalling past lives. And they do seem more common in some communities than others. But, my point is, for the memories of one specific life, I don't see how that could be happening through genetic transfer in these cases, because the recalling lives where it's not an ancestor. But, if you consider these children to be savants or whatever, to have this special ability, it may well be that special ability may have a genetic component to it.
Yeah. It starts to get metaphysical, right? I mean, I'm not trying to go all ancient aliens out on this and be like, could it be that the chakra record has all these things and that we're tapping into? Now, I'm not that guy. I actually was on an episode of Ancient Aliens, but I was the scientist. Oh. And I made some very clear factual statements about where genius comes from. The whole episode was, where does genius come from? Mm-hmm. And I made some statement like, well, we can't reduce genius entirely to the brain. And then the guy with the big hair said, what he means is, could it be that it's from the Akashic record? So
that's not what you meant.
That's not what I meant. But I think that you know, I think at this point in our conversation, it'd be fun to play around in the space of what is possible, what is going on. Now, of course, there are, I didn't mention the paranormal explanations, extrasensory perception has been one that has been put forward. But as you know, that doesn't explain the birthmarks. Possession. I'm fascinated with that one as well. You look at, people who feel like they're possessed by the devil, for instance, you know, and then you start to look at those cases more scientifically. You see there's mental illness, schizophrenia aspects that are more reasonable explanations than they were just possessed by the devil. It's not as cut and dry as that they were just possessed by the devil. And then, of course, the paranormal explanation of reincarnation. And you say that doesn't explain fully why the memory is so fleeting, for instance. Mm. Let's, you know, for remaining moments here, let's really play in the space of what is going on, Dr. Jim Tucker. Let's just get right down to it. You know, what could be going on in a way that science can explain someday? I mean, maybe we don't have the tools yet. Maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I think there are anomalies that in order to explain them, you don't start over with science, but you may have to sort of broaden some things. So, you know, just like quantum theory broadened classical physics, not that I'm saying this is like quantum theory, but you can't just, if you accept these cases, you can't just map them on to a materialist understanding of reality, because they involve some sort of transfer of mind, even if you don't accept it as reincarnation, but some sort of transfer separate from the physical. And taking sort of a larger view, as time has gone on, I've become more of a scientific or philosophical idealist. The idea that ultimately consciousness is at the core of reality and the physical grows out of it. And there are people a lot smarter than me, like Max Planck, the founder of quantum theory, who said the same thing, that ultimately reality comes down to consciousness. And that can be sort of a mind-bending thing. It can be hard to sometimes to kind of make sense of it. But if it's true that the physical grows out of the mental, essentially, then I don't see why an individual consciousness would be dependent on a physical brain, because in fact, the physical world is growing out of consciousness. So it would make sense that this piece of consciousness or mind that each of us has can continue on regardless of what happens to the physical body we're inhabiting. And then in our cases, at least, I have never said it's universal, but in our cases, at least, it seems that this mind has then attached to a new physical body and then continued on with a new mind.
So are you literally saying that you think the only way to fully explain the totality of evidence is one where we're going to have to disassociate the mind from or consciousness from the physical brain in some capacity, in some way?
Yeah, I mean, if you accept these cases, then yes, I think you're pretty much forced to conclude that. And, you know, each person can decide for themselves whether they should accept the cases, but I think if you look at our strongest ones as a group, I mean, they do provide good evidence that something's going on here, that these children do actually have memories of a life from the past.
I mean, there's so many deep implications of this if this is true, but what I want to really understand is why they're so fleeting, why the memory's so fleeting. Why don't people, when they get reincarnated, just get reincarnated as the total person for the rest of their life? Could there be mechanisms at play where that's just the way, like when you have a human psychology of immediate memories, it just inhibits past life memories, like that there's a huge conflict there, and the way the biological system reconciles that conflict is by, you know, by prioritizing the current immediate experience?
Yeah, I mean, typically these kids lose these memories, or most of these memories, at the same time that all kids lose memories of early childhood. Infantile amnesia or early childhood amnesia, where, as I'm sure you know, the brain is undergoing tremendous changes during this period, a lot of pruning and, you know, memories and sometimes skills or whatever, it sort of get left behind because others get prioritized. It would make sense that for most of these kids, they lose those memories at the same time they lose memories of their own childhood. Now, another related question is why there are such glimpses, why, you know, like you said, it's not like suddenly they remember everything from the past life. You know, the person hasn't just continued on. It's almost more like when you wake up and you've got glimpses of a dream, and sometimes you remember a lot of details, and then other times you got kind of images, but it's pretty hard to put them together, and you know, they can fade. That's how it is for some of these kids, that they will come out with certain details at certain times, but it's not like they can suddenly spout out the whole past life. So it's amazing that any memories would come through, right? But it's usually not a full, complete thing, but it really varies from child to child.
So do you think does your gut tell you that we're all reincarnated from some assemblage of prior things outside of our own genetic ancestry? Or do you think there are only special cases, like the ones you're discovering? There's so many questions to be asked about this. That's one. I'll stop there.
Yeah, well, I feel like our cases, again, do provide evidence that there can be this continuation. And I think that, I mean, I'm speculating, but I think that would apply to all of us. But it doesn't mean that all of us have lived here before or that we would be reborn here in this reality. You know, if consciousness is the core of all, I don't know why we couldn't have very different kinds of experiences and very different kinds of realities. So my own personal guess is that reincarnation is not universal in the sense that we all come back here, but that mind or consciousness, there is a piece that does continue on for all of us.
What do you think happens after we die?
Well, I don't know that it's universal. I mean, I don't know that we all have the same experience. I think that there are probably a lot of factors that go into what we experience next. And for some, it may be immediately coming back here, but for others, it may be very different. And, you know, if you look at near-death experiences, people where their hearts stop and then they have these experiences, there can be real variability. I mean, there are similarities, but there can also be real individual differences. And I suspect that is true for any of the afterlife kinds of experiences.
Well, what if you want to like increase the chances that you're going to live after you die? Should you die a violent death? I mean, is that what your research suggests? I mean, that's what it suggests. that you should have some dramatic ending. Make sure you have a dramatic ending, folks.
Well, but to have the memories come through, that may well be true. But, you know, it's just like traumatic memories in this life. I mean, there are memories when people have PTSD, memories that they wish they didn't have, but they couldn't get rid of them. There's a real strength, unfortunately, to traumatic memories, and that may well be the case across lifetimes.
Wow.
But as far as the kind of experience you have next, I mean, I would guess that it relates to the kind of experiences you have here and also the kind of life that you lead. I mean, not in a heaven and hell kind of sense, but just if you're focused on love and connecting with others and giving to others, you know, it seems to me that would affect your whatever it is that survives. And if we call it a soul, that would have an effect on your soul and then would affect what comes next.
Well, this is right. I'm a scientist and I really am curious what patterns you found among if you look at all the people, all the cases of the past lives, and you look at I'm a personality psychologist. I want to I want to crunch the numbers of the big five personality traits. Are there certain characteristics that they all have in common? Is there some, I feel like we can get this mystery, this would get us to this is real deep stuff. If we can discover what personality traits are more likely to make you live on after you die, I mean, that's some pretty heavy stuff there.
Well, we are doing a study now where we are interviewing adults who we originally studied as children because this work's been going on so long. And we are administering Big Five questionnaires to them.
Perfect.
We haven't gotten where we're done with the analysis yet, but we'll see if anything comes from that. I mean, my guess is, again, there's a difference between having memories versus surviving at all. I would be disappointed if it turns out certain personalities survive while others don't. You know, certain people's personality characteristics, but who knows? We'll have to see where the data leads us, I guess.
But wait, I think we might be talking about different things. I'm not talking about the big five traits of the person who is alive right now as an adult. I'm talking about what are the common characteristics of all the past lives? Like, what's the personality? You can do that analysis, right? You can't physically administer the big five to them, but I'm saying you can do the qualitative sort of impressions. Like, do these tend to be good people? Did they live good lives? Like, is there a pattern there, or some of them? Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I do. I mean, with the big five, yes, we don't have enough information for most of them to do any sort of reasonable assessment of that. As far as whether they were good people or not, there's quite a range. I mean, if you're more likely to have died violently, if that life is remembered, there are plenty of people who die violently through no fault of their own, but there are others who, you know, are involved in knife fights or, you know, whatever. So some of the people have been fairly nasty people who did some fairly nasty things, but then there are other people who are, you know, just kind of typical good people doing their best.
Well, that's really important information in itself. I mean, you're basically, you know, what if they're like listeners who are saying like, I want to increase the chances that like some 5-year-old remembers my life, you know, for 2 years.
Yeah,
that's all we get. But there's another part of this that's a bit disappointing, right? Like with the reincarnation stuff is like, what are you saying? Like the best extension we get is some, you know, annoying 4-year-old, like, you know, being like, oh, I'm Scott Barry Kaufman, you know, and then it's like no one believes them. And then, you know, 2 years later, they don't remember me the rest of their life. Like, are you saying that's the best I got in terms of extending my consciousness?
Well, it sort of.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying, but I like to view this as there may be sort of a larger self as well as the personalities that we have in each life. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if kid comes back and remembers your life, and then by the time they're school age, they've forgotten it. If there's a larger self that is part of your existence this time as well as the next time, then you hope that this larger self grows or learns or becomes more evolved, however you want to put it. You hope that each lifetime that there can be progress made, and you know that is just part of our journey.
My gosh. There's just so many implications, even for theories of consciousness. I'm sure you're aware of panpsychism. Yeah. I think that's the most compatible with what your theory is. My prior guest, my current episode that's up right now, you might want to listen to it, is with Antonio Damasio on the nature of consciousness. So you're going to be a really interesting counter.
He comes at it from a very different view.
Yes, he's not a big fan of panpsychism. But some people are. Some people that I'm friends with are. You know, it's I don't have a card in this horse personally. I want to know the truth. Mm-hmm. There's so many just deep implications of this, you know, and makes you just think about how does it all tie together? What does it all mean? Now, if we zoom out even further, right, like to the universe, we zoom out, you know, is the universe finite? Is the universe not finite? You know, I have this kind of intuition that physicists would probably disagree with. This is probably not possible, but I have this intuition that time just keeps looping back on itself, that like that we're going to like it'll get to some point of the universe, even if it's like 30 trillion years from now, they're kind of like whoops back again because I don't, you know, like, and that I'm going to live this life again. You know, like I really kind of feel that's the way it works.
Well, there are physicists who talk about basically new universes bubbling out of current ones, where it's an infinite number of universes. And if it's truly infinite, it means that at some point there'd be this same existence we have now that would be redone. Yeah, it all gets rather mind-boggling.
It does get mind-boggling, and you can kind of see, like, you know, error in the system. Like, maybe it's not a foolproof system, and that's what you're seeing in your cases, where like it starts to, like, you know, it's like, whoops, we put that person's consciousness over in that person's body for a couple of years. Whoops, you know, and maybe it's not even like a conscious entity that's doing it, but a process.
Well, that's right, and yeah. The process may get sort of short-circuited sometimes, particularly with sudden violent deaths where things don't go the way they typically do.
And then you have my friend David Chalmers writing a book, Are We Living in a Simulation? And he puts it as a greater than 50% probability that we are. What I'm saying is we need to tie all this stuff together and come with a unitary theory of of whatever with a scientific basis. Yeah. I mean, it's just funny even talk about. Dr. Tucker, if there are people listening to this episode who have cases of their children or even the kids themselves who are listening to my five are listening to my podcast and they want to report this to you, what can they do?
Well, they can contact us through our website, which is www.uvadops, which is Division of Personality Studies, DOPS.org. Or they can just Google my name and find us that way. But yeah, we'd love to hear from families if their children are talking about a past life.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for approaching a taboo topic with such scientific rigor. It's really refreshing to see that. And thanks for chatting with me today on my podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
Beautiful. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.